Accession number 10165, reel number 19.
Martin McLean, reel 19. Where were your unit when you rejoined them?
They were in a little place called Latoum, right up on the River Dyle. The River Dyle was a defensive position made by the Belgian army. It was a river with bridging across it, bridges, and it had a certain number of pillboxes and weighed positions. For instance, on one side of the road where we were, as you walked down this long valley, which transport couldn't go down, by the way, it was you had to walk down on foot. Horse and cart maybe get up, but army lorries were forbidden. That was the reason, were forbidden to go any further forward. And I'm pleased I landed back at Latoum, because my platoon of lads were just being used as fatigue men. Dig here, dig there. They weren't inveigled in any sort in a warlike plan, which was our job. And so I went and saw the Sergeant Major. I said, what's the idea of putting these men on this sort of thing? Company commander's orders. So I went and saw the company commander, who I mentioned before was a Captain Mann. And I said, sir, I want my platoon. I want to take them up forward and start digging in defensive positions and getting ready for the big shoots if anything should happen. So he started rollicking me because he was losing a platoon of working men. I said, sir, my job to give support to the British troops up front, our troops, our battalion, and I'm taking the guns, sir, taking the men now. So I had two trucks containing warlike stores, ammunition, night aiming kits, and all the sort of stuff that's applicable to a gun in action. Now, we had to carry the gun and the ammunition down to the front about 3/4 mile, right down to where Captain Annan, the man who got the VC, was in position on a bridge. And I'd done a reconnaissance of the area, and I saw our vanguard coming in. The lads had been forward to make contact with the Germans. They said, yes, they're there, they're coming up. And they had a bit of shooting match with them, but all their job was to report the Germans coming and get across this bridge. And the Royal Engineers blew the bridge with such a terrific bang, so that they closed the road after the vanguard got over. The vanguard is the advance party. And they came back. I always remember one lad met his wife much later and he went blind. He had a big Alsatian dog he got from somewhere. Always remember that. Just one of the little phases. And I had my platoon digging in, and we were in a very awkward position down in the valley of a high wooded area. There was no such thing as having an observation post where we could look down, because we'd been up there 2 or 3 times and we'd been sniped on and shot at, because the Germans were in such a command position they could see every little movement. If we'd got there maybe 2 or 3 days beforehand and had a proper covered in shelter, we'd have had an observation post there. But every movement we made, fortunately I wasn't hit, but they were sniping us, nearly hit us. You knew they were nearly hitting you. Anyway, I went down further down, got me positions for the mortars dug, and I went to a flank of this big house that was there. There was a huge house on the hill. I'd been speaking to the man in charge before the shooting started. I said, you want a vamoose tout suite, Alamein coming. He wouldn't have it, the Germans were coming. And he had a big, beautiful mansion, marvellous house. And at the finish, they had to get in the motor car and scram as fast as they could as soon as they heard the shooting. And they had to leave everything they had. I don't know what happened to it. I never went into the house, but I said, what a pity, but that was war. We just accept it.
Could you describe the positions you took up and the Anand's company? Was that deep?
Yes,
company?
I could do. We're at the foot of a valley, I could see. We came down a long winding track carrying our 3-inch mortar, and we landed at the flats, and running across a river in front of us was a long bridge, and the bridge was, I'd say, about 50 yards long, and it was a walled bridge with like balustrade inside, ornamental balustrades along the side, and it was about, I'd say, about 10, maybe 8 yards wide. It wasn't a massive bridge, it wasn't intended for transport, but whoever made it, I think it had been made for the people who owned that big house that was on the hill that I mentioned about. It was an ornamental sort of a bridge, but a straight bridge, absolutely straight. You could see straight into the corner of the other part of, I don't know where it was, but it was Belgium, across from us. It was on a crossroads, a busy crossroads. You could see all the people that was getting away from it all, the refugees, in their carts and go-carts and pushing past by the score, continuous rows of them. And just on our right was like a bit of a fortress thing. I don't know what it was. I never went inside of it. It was a flattish building, low. But it was, I don't know whether it was ever built as a fort by the French, but they had a pillbox not far from it. It was and that was a stupid sort of a pillbox. It was just stuck like a large shell, bomb. It was just a cylinder with a pointed top on, stuck in the ground mouth from anywhere on the side of the river. Captain Anand was involved with this. It's no mention on his citation. And we used to see Captain Anand's platoon on our left and in front of us, because we went behind the forward company, you see, with our three-inch mortar. But I was right on top of them, because the only place I could sight the mortars was behind this sort of flat castle sort of thing. And for an observation post, we went out in the flank and we dragged a fallen tree out of the forest and raised it up at the only hours of darkness and put another tree trunk under it, so we could see under it and see the frontage for observation posts, as we call it, for controlling the fire of the gun. Now, all this had to be done while we were down there, so we carried a load of ammunition down. We carried all our stuff down, and there's a D Company with Captain Hutton, who was transport officer, you know, being promoted as the company commander. He was in charge, and the men were all preparing their positions, getting ready for an attack, because they knew it was coming in by the Germans, or they knew we were going to meet up with the Germans. And we were working like blazes, getting our positions done. So, as a temporary measure, we had the gun there, and it could shoot, and I could put ammunition down to help people, put shell bombs down to help people that needed it. Now, up to this stage, and the whole of the campaign, not one order did I receive from my commanding officer. You go and support such and such company. You put your gun here and do what you can there. Now, by this time, I told you about the guns being US. I had one gun. This is the sad part of the quartermaster not doing his job. I'll just go back a little there. At No Main, I went and saw the quartermaster, as he Pearson. I said, sir, we'd like a tripod for the gun. And he shouted and yelled. I said, we've got a tripod there that's US, and we're going into action shortly. And I said, it's imperative we have a new gun. The place is at Arras. That's where they come from. And he says, he said, I'll indent for one. So they indent for one. Well, before we went to war, we had to hand in training stores and such stuff as we wouldn't be using in action. One of them was a slipper barrel, a cutaway barrel. I mentioned the tube, the long tube, the 3-inch mortar barrel. But on this one, a slipper barrel has a huge part cut away from the back, so that the men can practice dropping the bomb down. And it slides out the bottom, and then you can keep doing rapid fire so all the bombs go down. It's drill. So he indented for these tripods, and I've explained to him. I said, can I have a look at your catalogue? And I'll tell you the numbers and names. Because I can't say I was an extraordinary clever man, but I knew what I wanted, and I knew he didn't know what I wanted. Because he was grumbly listening to us. And, of course, I got around to the verbal abuse of him, being ex-RSM, and telling me, could he not run his job? Did he want to run this job and that and the other? Anyway, sent for one day, come and get your new equipment. You'll never believe it, as long as I sit here. Two slipper barrels, not tripods, two slipper barrels that was useless in action. Drill things that we were going up over the top shortly, never mind anything else. So this is when the war was hotting up. So I went back to him, and rather heatedly, I told him that no bloody good, this, that, and the other. And, of course, he had me stood to attention and put me in my place. But I was livid about this slipshod way that we're treating the 3-inch mortars, because this was all part of the heritage from the First World War. Nobody wanted the trench mortar near them, because once they fired, they brought in the fire from the artillery and everything to put them out. They were such a good weapon. But nobody wanted them. We're just an additional hazard, a useless thing. And I think just nobody wanted us. That's how I received no orders from the commanding officers and people. Not a company commander asked for support and fire. Then again, I said, it's urgent, sir. Can you indent for them again? Not them, but tripods. And I took one along and showed them this. The handles of these are useless. The screws are all worn. Maybe a workshop could do them up, but there's no workshop here. So off he sent again. Believe it or not, as God be my honest judge, two more slipper battles on the verge of into Belgium. So we went into action. There was one tripod that wouldn't work, that was useless, because even without any pressure, without the bombs firing, the screw was sliding down on the inside, and there was no method of tightening it. I tried various ways, hammering the thing, but it was cast iron, and it wouldn't work. So we just had one gun. We sighted it, put it in position. Now, we hadn't brought all our stores down to the front. A three-inch mortar platoon, fire by night also. But to have this, they must have night aiming posts out, aiming posts, and a night lamp. It's a little lamp which they put out and switch on when they want, so they can get their aim, their direction, and elevation, and all this sort of thing, so that they're on target, because you fire around, the first round, the gun jumps off beam. Second one, they come back on, and they get more accurate as the gun settles in. Went back to company battalion headquarters, and the company headquarters to get me trucks to get the stores off. And this is where I fell foul of the company commander. I says to the sergeant major, where's my so-and-so trucks? I'd hid them under camouflage and everything, and so was the signal truck and what have you. Oh, the company commander sent them back to B echelon. That's about 10 or 15 miles back. I said, does he know that I've got all my ammunition on there and all my warlike stores? It's an A echelon vehicle, and all the training manuals and books. Them trucks stay with us right up the front all the time. They carry our ammunition and our necessary stores for to maintain the gun in action. So I went and saw the company commander. Oh, I had to stand to attention. I was put in place. Don't you tell me my job. I nearly said to him, sir, you don't know your job. They sent these guns away, and I explained to him what I wanted, and he just wouldn't listen to me. He was just downright insolent. And here's my soldier trying to do his job, and he just wouldn't listen to me. Don't know what happened to him, don't know where he is. It's 40 years afterwards, so I can speak about it. The gun itself, we got in position, and we had no night aiming lamps, so we had no transport of any means now. Now, you've only got taken into consideration. A man carries six bombs down. Each bomb weighs 10 pounds. They're in like a holder of three, and he's got one in each hand, and he's got a good load on, with his own equipment and everything on, and he's got to carry them down at the front. So I eventually indented for my ammunition and got it brought up to us, not with my own lorries, not with my night aiming kit. I never got that. We had to make do with putting marks on the wall and things like that. Silly things. And even the microphone for a person to shout, not a microphone, a megaphone, for people to shout through, it had gone. Everything was gone, all were warlike stores. So some ammunition came up, and all my men were up front, and I asked for a carrying party from the battalion to carry them. And they gave us a carrying party from the company. Well, it takes a lot of men to carry, say, 100 rounds up to a gun, 140 rounds. And that's using the men laden. And I got a carrying party. And on the way down, the Germans got their eyes on this carrying party, and they start dropping mortars or shells among us. One lad was wounded. He's still alive today, lives in Sunderland. I didn't know he was one of the wounded. And somebody says, somebody's wounded. And I went along and saw him. And I said, I'd look at him. I says, well, you have to stay here. We'll come back. I said, there's no, we've got to get this ammunition up first. But it was priority, because we weren't involved with the action then, but we had to get the stores for action. Because they'd blown the bridge, and it was now a defensive post. We had to stay there till driven out or knocked out or ordered out, which we were eventually. This lad was left there lying wounded, and we got him back. Anyway, the next day the Germans appeared, and the shooting match started proper. The snipers had been out to tell you, shooting across at me, trying to find observation posts. But now the German army came up proper, in force. And we saw them coming up, so I had the mortars ranged onto this crossroad, and I fired a couple of warning shots away from there, just so that civilians would stop walking around there. You know, stop the flow of refugees. Whether we did or not, I don't know. We couldn't see that far. We could see the crowd of people passing. And we start hitting this crossroad every now and again. And according to reports of the Ford companies, we've done some excellent work with the 3-inch mortars, because I'd switch them from there to C company on our right to if I saw an attack coming in. Only one gun. Now the company commanders had seen the gun. Now they all wanted them. And nobody had any time for us before this. Not a heap of time. They didn't listen to any lecture given by me or Harry Quarthrow on what the 3-inch mortar could do, its capabilities in defence or attack or anything of this nature, or putting screens down smoke. They just weren't interested in it at all. And that was the attitude of the Regular Army, them days. We were, as I said, an experimental battalion. We were really up to date with weapons, but the officers didn't bother about them. So now they've seen this 1 3-inch mortar. Can we have mortars? Well, there's two in a battalion, you know. One was out of action. Finished. None. And they didn't even, the CO didn't even send for me. He was in his dugout. I never saw him at all. And we were given support and fire, whatever we sought, just chance targets, as we call it in our
first cavalry. High explosive you're using?
Yes. HE, very, very hard-hitting explosive shells. And they were very, very effective. When they dropped on this crossroad, they cleared everybody from there for quite some time. And we used to drop a stray bomb over now and again, just letting them know we're still watching that crossroad. We stopped a lot of German traffic that way. Maybe they went through by night, but we still dropped a bomb over now and again. We done some good work, I thought, there. And in this meantime, this bridge had been cleared, and the Germans done an attack, and they got into this riverbed. And I looked at it, and it was too near to our own troops for me to try to drop bombs in. It was only 75 to 100 yards in front of us. Well, the killing power of a bomb is 150 yards out over. So I couldn't possibly drop them anywhere near our own troops. And then I saw Captain Annan going forward with his hand grenades and grenading. The man never got shot. I told you, it's a straight bridge. It was quite some length. There's a far end of the road was this crossroads, a straight road running down it, a straight bridge with this gap in the middle, and a straight road out. How that man never got hit with all the shooting that went on, I don't ever know. It was a miracle, really.
What did he do exactly?
I say this honestly, because not because I know the man now, and whatever, we're great friends, but he went across this bridge with his grenades, because they could hear a German party had gone to the bottom riverbed underneath the bridge. They were a bridging party. They'd got in during the hours of darkness, but they were attacked and got in. And the wire, I tell you about the Belgians, they'd wired deep apron fencing on one side of the river, and on the other side, absolutely nothing at all, by this one silly pillbox, which only one gun could go in it. Anyway, he run across this bridge with his grenades, dodging here and there, ducking and skipping down, moving around, and he got the edge of the bridge, and he just unloaded his grenades. Get up there, get up. And he come back, and he caused devastation in that area. Now, I don't know who was in there, but anyone who was in there could hear them yelling, you know. You don't think the soldier dies peacefully. They yell and they scream when they're hit and wounded. I have no doubt about that. They scream for their mothers, a lot of them. But you could hear the screams coming from the place of the men badly hit. The dead wouldn't have anything to say about it at all. They were out of it. And then he went back, and the Germans attacked again this position, and they got another bridging party in. And he'd done the same thing again with his grenades, and went over and attacked this position. And he destroyed the German post in there. And it was reputed after the war he killed 40 Germans without all the others he'd wounded. And the Germans stopped all work on that, trying to support that bridge. He got wounded on his way back on that occasion. Now, before this little pillbox I was telling you about, the Germans during the night had overrun and took it. And see, he led off there with a corporal called Corporal Bell, who was a territorial corporal. We took great liking to him because he was territorial, some strange and regular battalion. And they attacked with a section of men, and they took this pillbox off the Germans again. And Corporal Bell got killed in the incident. No mention of that in the citation. But you see, people put the citation and they don't exactly know what happened. They got verbal reports, but there we are. Nobody asked me my opinions.
What did you think of Annan's feat, what he'd done? Did you think he deserved the Victoria Cross?
There wasn't a man in the area that saw him didn't think that he warranted a VC. There wasn't a heap of the doubt. We were asked to put recommendations in for awards to the for people who had been in action, you know, when we got back to England. And he was one of the men I wrote in about, told him what I saw. But with the multitude of reports coming in, they must have missed the pillbox part. But I'll tell you a little story later on about him and his VC. I'll tell you about this shoot, the fighting ground. The Germans made a big attack.
Before we go, had you known Anand before this?
Only met him as a platoon commander. He was a second lieutenant.
Had he shown any signs of being that sort of person?
No. He was an efficient officer. He came through us, I think he was from a universal unit, one of the same as Captain Mann, I think he was. I don't know whether he wore the DLI cap badge or not, but he was a new officer to me. I'd met him two or three times, and I liked him very, very much indeed. My impressions were that he was a good soldier.
But he hadn't shown any signs?
None at all. We didn't know any of the officers then, did we? Well, anyway, the Germans made an all-out attack, and I wasn't at the position this time. I was way back. My job was actually at battalion headquarters, waiting for orders from the commanding officer for where he wanted any movement of the gun, where they had to fire. We'd settled the other two or three attacks coming in, so I went back to the battalion HQ and sat beside the battalion headquarters. And the Germans overrun some of the positions on the front. Now, this is where cooperation between commanding officer and his mortar platoon and any support weapon, anybody involved where an attack's going in. I saw the Royal Welsh Fusiliers pass in front of me, heavily laden with all their shovels and everything on. I said, I wonder what's happening here. And I'm still sitting outside the command officer's bunker. Now, his job, officially, was to get me in, tell me they were putting an attack with the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. I knew me going inside out. I knew how to do all sorts of shoots. But one of the things they advise you not to do, don't shoot overhead if you can't see the enemy, if you can't see what you're shooting at. Well, I saw all the Royal Welsh Fusiliers coming in, and then I saw the men who were up my forward position come back, carrying some of the 3-inch mortar. They couldn't get the base plate out of the ground. I'm not sure whether it was the second in command of the adjutant at the time, Major Stallard, had gone forward and saw this overrun the positions. They were nearly overrun Captain Annan's position as well. But they were more on the right flank where the wire was down. And they nearly overrun the 3-inch mortars. And they told the 3-inch mortar men to get over, get your mortar, get your equipment, get out, just carry what you can. So they came up and reported to me. So I said, well, we're not finished yet. And they told me the Germans had attacked and taken this overrun some positions. And they were in the fields open on this riverside. Well, I knew I could hit this riverside from where I was with my 3-inch mortar. So I put it up, and I got the other base plate. Now we had the tripod and the barrel from the other gun. So we had a gun and ammunition. Why not use it? I couldn't see the target in front, but I could see the area. I could just see the river. And I said, right, I'll put a pattern of rounds on there to stop any further attack. Let them know that that area is covered. Normally with an OP, you'd be able to, in a position to sight. We didn't have any long speaking equipment. We didn't have any wireless to shout control back. You had to be within voice control from the gun. Now, we put over a barrage of fire, and unbeknownst to us, the Royal Welsh Fusiliers launched into attack at the same time, and we knocked some of them down. Now, I don't know how many were knocked down. It's something I didn't want to know about. I drew my pistol out, my holster, and I was going to shoot myself then and then, because of this great blunder, which I thought I'd made. But the blunder wasn't mine. It was a blunder now that when I think sensibly on the command officer and the people concerned for not telling me the Royal Welsh Fusiliers were going to attack from the positions that we had just vacated. If I'd known, I would never put a shot down there, because I knew, as I told you about the river, I knew it was dangerous. But I knew the Germans were in the area, and I was dropping shells on the other side of the river and dropping bombs. But anyway, the Welsh Fusiliers went down in this attack, and I felt mortally depressed about this. The whole of the time I was in France from then, this thing got in my mind so much. I was a mental wreck by the time after the Arakan threw the thing. Just thinking the thing that killed me own men. But when I talked to different people later on, actually, I might as well tell you, psychiatrists, they told me that I was blameless. And their sole blame was with the commanding officer, because they had a breakdown through too much fighting, too much active service later on. And they told me I was blameless, which I've accepted now. I wasn't blameless, but I talk about it now, which I would never have talked about before. Royal Welsh Fusiliers getting killed through me taking a chance shoot up with a 3-inch mortar, which I'd have got away with if it hadn't been for that attack going in. I'd have done some good with it because I was pretty efficient with the mortar, and that was it. Now, we, from there, we're in Latoum by the battalion headquarters when the shoot took place. We had no transport to cart our stuff, nor the balance of the ammunition back. In a farm just near where a battalion headquarters is a farm, where my lads had put their stock of ammunition and stuff. In there, the people had vacated the area, and there was a big, beautiful grey horse in there, and a milk float, an ordinary milk cart, two-wheel milk cart. So one of the lads knew a lot about horses. He harnessed the horse up, and we're told we got to withdraw, and we loaded this milk wagon up with a 3-inch mortar and the ammunition that we could possibly carry on this thing, and we dragged this all over the country on the withdrawal. That poor horse collapsed. But we still didn't have no trucks. Now, the foolhardiness of it all, if they had given us the trucks and the other 3-inch mortar, we'd been of great value to the battalion. And it's so they're fighting, you know, all over the shop. We were ordered to dump our stuff once the horse died. And we became riflemen after that.
Now, as the German attacks came in, was there panic amongst the officers at the headquarters? Not panic, that's not... Do you think they were in control of the situation?
I must say this, and I speak without any worry at all. All of the officers, every man of the regiment was in full control. I never saw one bit of panic anywhere. The only thing they were annoyed about, like myself and others, having to leave valuable equipment that they couldn't cart out through not having stock. Everything was done as an orderly withdrawal. The Royal Scots... regiment, they covered our withdrawal. They were up on a hill lined across the open fields as we withdrew, and there was no panic whatever. I was back on my motorbike, which I eventually lost, stuck in the mud, couldn't get it out, and it was sunk in so much that I was told to abandon it, because all these water-legged areas, you know, Belgium, not properly drained. And we made an orderly withdrawal, and then we took the positions further back and back and back.
When this was your first time in action, how did you feel under fire? The first time you've been under fire properly, how did you react yourself to it?
I found I just accepted as a soldier should, no bother at all. But a lot of men who spoke to me later on felt bad about shooting to kill somebody. I had no qualms because they tried to kill me up on that hill, and they wounded one of my lads, and I'd seen the other lads dead. I had no qualms about shooting to kill. Even all of the war had no qualms in that. When I shot to kill.
Were you scared at all?
No. I must honestly say I was not scared. I'll give you one little instance. I was back in battalion headquarters, and I always had a feeling, don't ask us, you get these little feelings. I'm not trying to be brave, I'm not trying to show anything. You've asked a question, I'll tell you. They were dropping 3-inch mortars in the area. There were a bomb that seemed to go for a terrific explosion, but no end results. And I was standing up where these mortar bombs were coming, and I was trying to control a flow of men, the same as I did with the Rajput Indians when I was in Arakan. And I was just saying, take it easy, take it easy. If you hit, you hit. Walk out slowly during the withdrawal. These shells, these things were plopping, plop, terrific bang. And I don't know around this, but I knew as long as I was in the army, don't ask us how, the only time I'd be hit when I was lying down, and sure enough, that's how I was hit. Lying down. So I stood among these shells trying to tell the blokes to take it easy. There wasn't any panic, but one or two men start running out of order, which is fair enough through a field that was being hit by shell fire, but no bother at all, out went. And that was my first dose of being mortar bombed or shell, whatever it was that was hitting the area around us.
Now, I know it's a sensitive subject, but after you made the mistake, or the you know, whoever's fault it was, there was a mistake had been made. You said you tried to shoot yourself or went to. Well, who restrained you, or what happened? Or did you stop yourself? How did you cope with it immediately?
The men stopped us. They knew straight away by my accent, somebody just hit me hand. And I think they called the lad Jones. I'm not so sure, but one lad just hit me hand. He says, nah, not worth it. And it was all going to be done in a flash. It had been over in a flash, we hadn't stopped us. But no, I didn't shoot myself. I lived on to fight again, and I'd done some good work after that.